Hi, my name is Edward Burke, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production by Neural, an agency that helps both brands and talent tell their story. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's NERALLE.com. My guest this week is Ed Burke, back again, former guest, fame fan of Donald Trump, executive director of Victoria Ford, and what was I saying before? The Victorian left's number one fan.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Now, I was just thinking about it the other day. I think Lauren and I were listening back to your older episode.
Yeah.
What's changed since we last caught up on Spring Street?
Well, I think basically everything. I mean, it's been a few years. A lot's changed.
Yeah.
I mean, people change, I think, in the natural course of time. But
yeah.
I think particularly, I like to think of myself perhaps as a fairly dynamic person.
Yeah.
So I like to think that I change with the times.
Yeah. You graduated. Are you studying at the moment?
Yes.
What are you studying?
Double degree, law and arts.
Law, arts. What school?
Victoria University.
Victoria.
And I just recently finished a course in public policy economics with Oxford University.
Nice. That's a really interesting thing at the moment because there's a guy that I follow who works at NYU Stern. He's probably like probably the greatest tech and marketing sort of commentator in the US. Always fucking blank on people's names mid-interview, but it doesn't matter. We'll link it later. The point is that he has said for probably the last year or so now that the universities are in deep trouble when it comes to how they make money.
Oh, no doubt.
And COVID really sort of accelerated that. You know, it's been the case here. At least we can still go to university and be on campus and so forth. But in places like North America, the UK, they're in a lot of trouble.
No doubt.
Particularly because the cost over there is so high.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with organisations like Oxford and how they sort of develop and change over the next couple of years. Like, do these online courses become really the standard for how they offer education? And part of that may be that you have a tiered system where it's fully remote versus remote and on-site versus fully on-site.
I think it's a good system because basically with the one I did, it's a several-month course.
Yeah.
And you're effectively, it is accredited by the university. You get credits for it. But it's
you wouldn't do it otherwise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's essentially you choosing a subject or a unit, which is usually part of one of their larger courses, to do an intensive on. Where, you know, public policy economics is obviously something that's very pertinent to the work that I do, whereas a lot of the other subjects, perhaps in one of their courses, aren't quite as pertinent.
Mm.
So it allows sort of that intensive focus that I think is valuable for most people in the workplace.
Yeah. So how many months again was the course?
I can't quite remember. I want to say it was about 2 or 3 months.
Okay. Yeah, so they
a regular unit of it.
Yeah, okay. So it is like a regular unit. That's really interesting. Yeah, I think it's going to be intrigued to see what happens. My brother's in his final semester in Melbourne of he was doing his Master of Math, then he switched to computer science. Yeah. And he said it's just been a bit of a, not a shambles, but it's just, you know, everything's up in the air.
Yeah, it is, absolutely.
And, you know, when you're paying, not full fees, but if you're paying hex, et cetera, you sort of start to question, like, what am I doing?
And especially people who are perhaps in the humanities where those costs are
definitely
going to,
in the humanities,
those
yeah.
costs are going to increase.
No. Costs are going to increase. The hireability is going to decrease. Mm. Like hard skills are everything at the moment. So, like I said, you just graduated. I think you and I, we spoke maybe a year or so ago. We actually had the same operation, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, very similar.
Do you still have the bolts?
Oh, they'll be there forever.
They'll be there forever, yeah. It's one of those cool party tricks where you tell people about it and they're like, oh, really? And then you get to show them. Like, did you get both jaws or just the bottom?
Yeah, both. A lot of my face is now
really
titanium.
Really?
Yeah. So much so I have to carry a letter with me to airports in case anything set off or x-rays or I don't look like my passport photo, obviously.
Really?
So.
Wow.
Because the last time I travelled internationally was 2019, which was sort of midway through my surgeries.
Yeah.
And I did have to take a letter. Luckily, I didn't need it, but because I look so different already to my passport photo, I had to.
How did you find just with the jaw surgery in particular? Because I found that it was, obviously very confidence building, but because I looked completely different. Mm. But the biggest thing for me was actually just you didn't realize how much it impacted your eating and general lifestyle. Like, absolutely. I used to have really bad, like, muscular pain here.
Yeah.
Because it was like you were overstretching the jaw muscles in a way.
And I think the orthodontic element was the most shocking for me, is you don't realize how uneven your teeth are until your jaw surgery is done and then they start trying to realign your teeth.
Yeah.
You don't realize how completely out of line they were. And I think that was the most surprising to me, is how I thought my teeth weren't that bad as far as maybe my jaw was, but my teeth themselves, but obviously they'd grown to line up with the jaw. So when that changes, you realize that they're in completely the wrong place.
Did they ever mention to you as to why it often happens? Because I found it interesting in the last couple of years, I learned about this guy and his father, who are both orthodontists in the UK.
Yeah.
And there's this area called Mewing.
Yeah.
Have you heard of Mewing at all? No, it's like this idea that you can change most major orthodontic issues by certain mouth-related activities because what has happened in the last 60, 70 years is our diet has changed dramatically and our lifestyle has changed so much that it affects the arch of the upper jaw, which then affects everything. Yeah. So this idea of Mewing is an area of orthodontics now that is well peer reviewed, and this guy has like found it.
Yeah,
it's really interesting.
I have to say, I didn't go too much into the effect of the original source of mine, but I think from what we learned through the surgeries is that I have exceptionally strong bone growth in my lower jaw, like more so than would be in any sort of regular person. I have a very strong lower jaw.
Yeah.
To the point that even after my first surgery, my jaw pushed back out. The bone regrowth was so rapid and so strong.
Really?
That it pushed the metal plate out. It pushed my jaw back out. Mm. So they had to go back and revise it to then take more bone out because of how strong the growth was back.
Wow.
So I think it must have something to do with that sort of bone growth and the strength in the bone growth.
Yeah. It's a fascinating surgery.
Oh, totally fascinating.
I just remember coming out of it and they've got you dosed up on drugs for the pain.
Yes.
And just like you go look at yourself in the mirror and you're just like immediate panic mode, like what the fuck is going on here? Because I was really swollen.
Yeah.
I had really bad inflammation afterwards.
And you just got to get back onto it. I mean, after my revision, my second jaw surgery, I was back to work within 24 hours.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. How did you go eating afterwards? How long did it take to get to solids?
Yeah, so I tried my best to be as good as I could on not solid food. But I found...
Yeah, I know what that means.
Yeah, exactly. I did try my best. But I did pretty well. The first time around, perhaps I didn't work quite as hard to remain on soft foods, which perhaps maybe contributed to my jaw growing. But who knows? But the second time, I was much more committed to being off solid foods for probably longer than I had to be. Because the last thing I wanted was a third jaw surgery, because they're not the most enjoyable.
They're not enjoyable. They're not cheap either.
No, they're not.
And it's more the recovery than anything. Mm. It's just how long that takes. But I think from memory, I lost something like 5 kilos or something.
I lost
like
15% of my body weight after the first surgery.
Jesus.
Yeah, and I didn't have much to lose to begin with.
Yeah, you didn't have much.
I lost 15% of my body weight after that.
Yeah, because you would have had already being a skinny guy, you would have had a high metabolism.
Oh, yeah, true.
And we're just...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the craziest part. So you lose all this weight, but then, like for me, because I had that inflammation, my face was just like...
Yep.
Yeah, that wasn't fun. So probably the most recent thing that you've had going on.
Yeah.
Did I say leader of Victoria for it or executive
director? I think he's an executive director.
Okay, good. Always want to be sure about that. Is probably Victoria Forward. So you've got this conservative political group on Facebook. I think from last count last night, there was just under 32,000 followers. Very heavily stylized in that sort of populist conservative movement that you've seen come from probably the US. It's always fun to see commentary about it. Because people like to drum things up more than they are or they aren't.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I go from being... See, the amazing thing about the left is there are only two schools of thought, really, is that one, I'm a nobody, right? I'm just some teenager nobody. And then the other... And they're the same people that have the same views. The other extreme is that I'm some nefarious puppet of the world's billionaires.
The Murdoch.
Yeah, the Murdoch. And people talk about conservatives with their conspiracy theories. I've never seen so many conspiracy theories as there are about people, myself and people like me from the left.
But I'm going to be honest with you, that is one thing about politics that I find very funny is no matter the side, there is a belief of the other side that is like that.
Absolutely, and I think it's totally ludicrous on both sides.
Yeah.
Totally ludicrous.
It's funny, but
it's
funny.
It's hilarious. It is absolutely hilarious. It's the most entertaining thing I read.
Yeah, because this is, these are the two opposing quotes I had.
Mm-hmm.
A little boy playing dress up, mm-hmm. but the opposing one was up and coming Antipodean Steve Bannon.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is, it's really, really, with an affected Etonian sensibility, which is really, really funny. So you've obviously gotten into you've come straight out of the gates after high school, brother, and you've gotten back into the political swing of things. Mm. I feel like you probably found, you know, a lot of people give you shit for all the different business names and things that you create, but you can sort of see at a young age that that is really a process that brings you to something like what exists today.
And I think people. I mean, one of the funniest things is, and I think it does illustrate the left's lack of understanding about how things work, is that they take every business name I register as another company that I've started, which is just how business names work.
Mm.
If you have an idea and you don't want someone else to ever be able to use the name, you register the business name and then you use it for a little while. If it doesn't work out, pick it up later, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's like registering IP, not by IP addresses, but domain
names. It's exactly the same, really, in many ways.
Yeah.
And I think it's important if you're someone like me and I have ideas running through my head day after day, every day, that you at least take some action to act on your idea. Yeah. I think the worst thing you can do, even if you have no intention of really like taking it to be a $1 billion company or $1 billion enterprise or whatever it might be, I think if you have an idea and you think it's a good idea, it's good for yourself to take some sort of progress to action that.
Yeah.
Whether it be registering a domain name, registering a business name, which is not expensive.
Yeah.
But what you're doing internally is you're taking some action to begin that process.
Yeah, and you put it out there. I remember I'm reading a book I just finished at the moment with Naval Ravikant. He's probably one of the smartest VCs I've ever come across in the US. Originally born in India, moved to Canada. He's well known for AngelList, which is sort of a big pre-Series A, B type fundraising platform. And he talks about, and I used to do this as well, he talks about how sometimes you just need to put it out there that you're doing this thing, and that in and of itself creates a pressure that makes you go do it. Like he was working at a workplace and he would say, you know what, I'm done with this shit, I'm just going to go start my own business. And then it would be 3-4 months later and he'd been talking about this and people started saying to him like, why are you still here?
Mm.
And he's like, oh. And that was the moment where it clicked that sometimes you just need to put it out there, tell a friend. Because you know, and I have friends that pull me up on things, and it's sort of good when you get it out there. It's like a forcing function in a way.
Absolutely. I think if you don't put things out there, what you're doing is you're really just lying to yourself. Mm.
But that is the funny thing about politics is that no matter the side, if it's opposing, they'll only see the negative and one side will only see the positive, which is just... probably one of the things why I've started to check out more and more from politics other than higher level issues. But Victoria Forward, let's clear the air. What are you up to there?
Well, it's a political action group.
Yeah.
You know, in the truest sense of the word, we're not a party. We don't have ambitions to be a party. We won't run candidates, things like that. We're there to action political issues and to ensure more than anything that, you know, there is Get Up on the left and there are things like that on the left. And I have no problem with GetUp existing. I mean, they clearly see themselves as a form of accountability for Liberal federal governments, Liberal state governments in whatever sense, and they hold them accountable and they campaign at elections.
Yeah.
That's democracy. There's no reason that I shouldn't have an organisation to hold someone accountable or a side accountable or both sides accountable, depending on the issue. And I'm very big that Victoria Forward doesn't necessarily take sides on politics, we take sides on issues.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm very much for example... I'm very much for the privatisation of Vic Roads or certain elements of Vic Roads. Michael O'Brien, the leader of the Liberal Party, certainly is not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would have no problem campaigning for privatising Vic Roads.
But he wouldn't.
But he wouldn't. So it's not really a partisan issue.
Yeah.
This is an issue.
This is a sort of new thing that's, like strategy-wise, a new thing that has started to exist. And It's funny reading this Gizmodo article, and they're putting you in this rarefied air of sort of the IPA and whatnot. I think you mentioned in a past interview, or there was a comment, that the style and structure of United States political action committees is very effective.
Yep.
And I hope to prove that those strategies also translate well in Victoria. So let's talk about the get-ups of the world, the IPAs, organisations like yours. Yep. What are they? Are they a form of political strategy for the parties or the people concerned with backing the parties?
Well, fundamentally, Victoria Forward is completely different to the IPA.
Right.
Fundamentally, the IPA would label themselves, I think do label themselves, as a think tank.
Okay.
So they're very focused on...
like a Grattan Institute or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah, and they're very focused on policy formation and, you know, filing out these reports, which are extremely interesting to read, sure, but they're very focused on that policy aspect.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call them a political campaigner.
Okay.
In any real sense of the word. They're more of an intellectual body, I would say,
okay,
than a campaign-focused body. Whereas GetUp is completely different. GetUp is very much a campaign-focused body.
Okay.
In that same way, Victoria Forward, we're not focused on... we have policies on our website, of course, so people can get an idea of what our values and vision is, but we're not focused on churning out reports on different policies or analytical statements about this or that, because there are great organisations like the Menzies Research Centre and the IPA that do that. We're focused on the campaigning element.
Okay.
Because I think that's where there has been a vacuum in recent times, especially in Victoria, around, I suppose you could call it conservative politics, small government politics, whatever you want to call it. There's been a real campaign vacuum there.
Why do you think there was a vacuum?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think there is unquestionably one. We look at the 2018 election result, that you couldn't call that anything but a failure in campaign messaging.
Yeah.
Here
in Victoria.
Yeah, with the Liberals, it was a wipeout.
Yeah.
And I'm not one of those people that sits there and goes, oh, well, it was this, oh, well, it was that, oh, well, we ran a bad campaign, that's the reason. If you run a bad campaign, you lose.
Yeah.
Don't cry about it, that's what happens.
Yeah, it was a pretty shit campaign.
Yeah, and the only way to fix that is run a better campaign.
Yeah.
And that's what Victoria Forward is focused on, is running better campaigns and good campaigns with good messaging and clear messaging, which I think has been lacking overall. And again, I mean, it's good to have an avenue where, I mean, we receive absolutely no funding from the Liberal Party. We receive absolutely no structural or organisational support from the Liberal Party.
Mm.
You know, so I have complete and utter independence and control over that. And that's something that's very important to me as well, as much as people like to paint me as some sort of nefarious puppet. Yeah. That's just not the case.
That's the funny thing with that article. Okay, so I'm starting to understand this better. You've got the politicians, let's say, representing the individuals. Mm. And then when it comes to each side of politics, you have think tanks that will push certain policy agendas and will actually start to formulate it to those individuals. And then you'll have organisations like yours and GetUp, which are more about campaign strategy and messaging more than anything.
I think in energising the voting public about issues, making sure they're informed about the issues. So I would say the IPA and other organisations of that ilk, that intellectual policy ilk, would be far more focused on pushing things in what you could call the back room.
Yes.
So even if it is public, like committees and, you know, committee hearings and private meetings with ministers, shadow ministers, things like that, that's where I think they would be pushing those policies.
Yeah.
Whereas Victoria Forward and grassroots organisations like GetUp are very much focused on that front end.
Okay.
Of how are people reacting to this? How is the voting public reacting to this?
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, the policies affect the voting public more so than anyone else.
Yeah.
Really. And it's important that those people have a voice and feel like they have an impact. It's not good enough. And it's not good enough just to feel, you have to have an impact. But they feel like they're having an impact. They are having an impact in a real way.
Yeah.
Which they can't really have in those major organisations.
So if we think about, like the obvious one with the Grattan Institute and IPA, et cetera, they've obviously got donors or principals that donate to them, and they may get paid for some consulting gigs, et cetera. GetUp, the obvious thing to me is they get paid via donations, probably, most likely. Is it a similar thing with organisations like Victoria Forward? It's just donation driven?
Well, Victoria Forward is heavily regulated and actively regulated by the VEC. Since 2018, when Daniel Andrews brought in his new electoral fundraising laws and political fundraising laws, we are heavily restricted. We can't take a donation from any one person that's more than $4,000 in an election period of that 4 years.
Yeah.
So really more than $1,000 a year. So we rely heavily on those grassroots donations and those sort of individual small donations,
yeah,
which is good. I think that's a good thing. you know, I think it's good to be reliant on those. And everyone's saying that, you know, they're nefariously funded by billionaires. Well, that's not the case.
But the thing is that you can look it up anyway.
Well, yeah, when we file our first filing, because obviously we haven't been around long enough to do one yet.
Yeah.
It will all be public, people who have...
But, as an example, in Advance Australia, you can look up and see what... Yeah.
And, so, you know, they have the benefit of being able to fundraise on a much larger scale because they're a federal... focused organisation, and we can fundraise on that level for federal campaigns.
Yeah.
But certainly for state campaigns, we are fundraising just like, you know, any political party. We're regulated in the same way by the same bodies.
Yeah.
And I'm quite active in ensuring I have contact with the VEC and ensuring that everything's done by the book.
Yeah.
Which perhaps some other, I'll use the word more renegade organisations aren't quite as focused on.
Of course. There's always going to be those types, I think. No, I'm pretty happy with... that legislation, I think it's good. It just opens it up on either side. It doesn't really matter. You can see what people are...
Yeah, I have some opinions on that. Very much, yeah. I think that the caps on donations of $4,000 over a certain amount of time, things like that, I think are detrimental to competitive elections, personally. Mm. What I am very much keen and supportive of is disclosure arrangements. So I think that I personally think you should be able to donate as much as you like. If you want to donate $1 million to a campaign, donate $1 million to a campaign. But I think the public deserves to know that you are pushing this campaign or that campaign. That's something the public deserves to know.
Mm.
And I think as much as organisations should handle their donations, and we do, and our membership with the extreme discretion, transparency is important in government. And whether it be not necessarily a person, whether you might set up a foundation to donate to political causes, you might set up a company to donate to political causes, whatever it might be. But the actual names that are on the checking slip, they should be public and transparent in a way that is honest.
Yeah.
It's not a way to say, oh, gotcha, you're supporting this, you're supporting that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a way to say, well, we're being honest. Yeah. You know, and I don't see GetUp out there, you know, advertising all of their big money donors.
No.
But, you know...
That's just part of the game.
Yeah.
This is part of the game. I think... I very much like the current system. I can see what you're saying with the cap on donations being an issue. I mean, look, it's better than the US system at the moment in terms of the way that things are disclosed, let's say. What have you learnt about this game since getting into it? When was Victoria Forward founded?
January 5th.
Of this year?
Yes.
Really?
Of this year.
I thought it was last year. Anyway.
No.
So what have you learnt so far?
Well, I mean, quite simply, politics is an extremely complex game. I did know that already through my previous work. But I think what I've learned is, one, well, something I always did, and as we were talking about, honesty and transparency is very, very important.
Mm.
But at the same time, as much as you should, you know, embrace the role of honesty and transparency, discretion is also incredibly important. You know, you need to be trustworthy, both to the people that you're in concert with and those that you are performing to. So that is the most important thing, is you must be transparent enough with the people you're performing to, but also discreet enough with the people you're in concert with to move forward. Because if you breach trust either way, then that's just going to be detrimental to your reputation.
Yeah.
You know, for one example, the media liked to try and paint it like I had completely hidden and buried the fact that I was a Liberal Party member.
Yeah.
But that had been public information since I founded Victoria Forward.
Mm.
Just no one had had a problem with it to bring it up.
Yeah, well, a lot of that stuff is sort of stated on the About section, et cetera. Yeah. But that's part of political media, though.
Oh, it is.
You know, like bring up all these points to push a point is often the way to go.
I don't sit at home getting upset. I do the same thing on Victoria Forward. I mean, we make a point. We make it a very specific way.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always paint a particular politician or a particular bureaucrat in the best light, quite simply because we don't think they deserve to be painted in such a good light around certain issues. So I don't sit at home and cry about people painting me in a bad light. That's life.
It's just the way it is. Now let's talk about, I thought I'd give you the opportunity to clear the air on the whole Boots controversy thing.
I'm happy to.
I read the statement. I thought it was pretty good, but I did notice in the last paragraph about saying the Premier may be attempting to use this one admittedly regrettable image to distract from the fact that Victorians have rejected his leadership, blah, 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 blah. Which, I mean, I see it for what it is, as a sort of, it's a political stratagem, because I know that Well, this is the interesting thing about personal stuff when it comes to politics, because it's both used for and against people as a strategy, no matter what. So obviously it happened.
Hmm.
Do you know who the people were that did it?
Yeah. You the do? Owner of the property.
The owner of the property?
Yeah. The Andrews government sold that property 4 years ago to the person who posted that image. They're the current owner of the property. It had nothing to do with the Andrews family. And that's public knowledge. There are some journalists that tweeted about it. He is the current owner of the property. He's known to the Andrews family. Doesn't support Premier Andrews. So he took a photo of his brood outside his own farm.
Interesting. That's very interesting. So when you said the Andrews government owned that property,
the Andrews
family.
The Andrews family.
Okay, so they owned that private property.
Well, they
did
until 4 years ago.
Wow.
When they sold it to this gentleman, who obviously doesn't support the Andrews government.
Yeah.
So was voicing his legitimate protest outside his own home.
Yeah.
And he's known to the Andrews family. He worked for them.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, that's very interesting.
So, I mean, I won't
because have... Because you didn't hear anything about that.
And I won't have people tell me that Daniel Andrews didn't recognise that person's name.
Really?
And I won't have people tell me that because that's, to me, as ludicrous as anything else.
Yeah. This is what I mean. This is the fun of politics.
I know, absolutely. I find
fascinating. Because, yeah, like, obviously that kicks up his base really, really well.
Hmm.
Really well.
But it had absolutely nothing to do with his father's funeral.
Yeah, but you can't, you know, you can't explain nuance in political debates. It's just you've got an image, you've got it's how it's messaged up.
Absolutely, exactly. And that is the way of the world.
That's the way it goes.
You know, I won't have people tell me that, you know, Premier Andrews didn't recognise the name of someone who'd been an employee for his family for some time, who then bought his parents' property off them.
You're right.
I mean, come on.
like I said, it's that's a pretty good strategy by him. You got to give it.
Well, it's classic Daniel Andrews.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it, in some ways, you know, I hate to say it, but I think it justifies that final paragraph.
Yeah.
Of my initial statement.
Yeah, but to his base, they don't understand that. And no. This is why he is such a, you know, for all the policy agreements I may have with him, like he's a fucking good politician.
Oh, absolutely.
Like he's really good at messaging.
I think beyond that, he pays very good advisors.
Yes. Yeah, that'd be interesting. I don't know anything about his team or his advisors or anything like that, but that was probably the biggest thing that came from the last election is how poor the messaging was from the Liberal side, and it sort of explains why you've gotten into this so keenly. Because I just remember thinking that is like the strategy from the Liberals was really, really poor.
It was, and I think that does come down to a reliance on staffers rather than outside consultants.
Okay.
So there are people who are campaign specialists and work on campaigns, you know, all over the world for a reason, because they're good at it. You know, I don't think it's feasible to rely solely on staffers in a campaign.
And why would they, do you think, rely solely on staffers? Is it just easier for them personally, or is it a funding issue, or is it something else?
I think it's partly an issue of not wanting to appear the same as Daniel Andrews hiring all of these outside staffers and consultants, because it would come out in the media. You know, you better believe the Age would be the first one reporting that the Liberal Party of Victoria had spent $600,000 on X company to run their campaign.
Yeah.
But it's been used to great effect by the Federal Liberal Party. I mean, we know that Sir Lynton Crosby, the very, very famous political consultant who has led successful campaigns in the UK and for John Howard here in Australia, very, very famous. It was effective for them. And I think it's important, as much as there are some excellent staffers out there, you can't rely solely on that. You need to make sure your messaging is coming from an outside source that doesn't necessarily have any ambitions within the party or to please anyone in the party.
Well, it's just a very different type of person.
Yes.
You know, staffers may be, obviously they're not in the public service, but these are people that are committed to whatever political cause that they're working with. But they are 9-to-5 employees. They are incentivized by a salary. That bandwidth is going to be very different from, it's like being in agency land, from an agency that is incentivized by money, let's say, to come up with the best message for whatever the thing may be.
And it's a very different type of relationship.
Yeah.
The relationship between a staffer and whomever is employing them.
Yeah, yeah.
And the relationship between a consultant and a client are two very, very different relationships.
Yeah, because a staffer is going to have it harder pushing back, whereas a consultant can just tell the person to get stuff, basically.
Well, you have to tell it how it is. Yeah. This is what a campaign is going to be like, and this is how it's going to run.
Yeah.
And, you know, I spend all day, every day, making sure that I'm aware of the opinions of everyone you could imagine in the state.
Yeah.
You know, basically, and how people's opinions are shifting and where they're shifting and how much they're shifting and who they're shifting towards. And you have to be aware of all of these microcosms of the democratic process in order to make sure that we have the healthiest democratic process that we can have.
Yeah.
You know, ignorance breeds, you know, deception in many ways. If you just ignore everything, it allows for people to come in and corrupt the system. So being aware of the system in its entirety and all of its nuances and microcosms is one of the most important things we have in democracy.
Yeah, and it's what, in a way, that they're paying you for as well. So if you think about globally in the last 4 years, who are the real political consultants that you respect and admire or at least have start to learn some principles from?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think there are a lot of political consultants out there that all do it very, very differently. Obviously, Sir Lyndon Crosby is sort of an icon of the industry in that way. And
Lyndon Crosby,
yeah. Crosby Texter Group is his group.
Okay.
And there's someone whose surname is very annoyingly escaped me just now, Dominic.
Oh.
You would know who I mean. He ran the Brexit campaign.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. He was a minister with
He was a senior advisor for Boris Johnson.
Oh, for Boris Johnson. Okay. And, okay. I'm thinking about another guy who was a he may have been the Chancellor of the Exchequer for the previous government. It's not Dominic Cummings, is it?
Yes, it is. I think it is, yes. Yes, it is. That's correct. Well done.
Yeah.
Just slipped my mind there for a moment. yes. But I think he's a good example of someone who really just said it how it was. This was the campaign you had to run. This is how you had to run it. You either run it that way or you lose. Choose. And he really worked with them to make a successful campaign. And unfortunately, some mishaps later on in his career, I don't believe he's an advisor anymore for Boris Johnson, I think.
Now that I know exactly who you're talking about, the only reason I knew this guy's name is because he obviously went to visit his partner during the lockdown. That's how he became known to me. But so he was chief advisor to the PM. Pretty young guy, 49 years.
Extremely talented.
Yeah.
Political strategist, extremely talented.
Did you ever, after Trump's win, watch many of Bannon's interviews? I found it really interesting.
No, I didn't. I'm not a particular fan.
You don't like him?
Not particularly.
How come?
I don't find him to be the most palatable person in the world.
He's an unusual character.
I think he's a very extreme person.
Yeah.
And not particularly in the right ways.
Okay. Because, it's funny because so many articles would like to paint you in that light, but you say that. That's very interesting.
Oh, people like to think that I'm a fan of Steve Bannon and people like that because that's how they imagine me to be this extreme figure.
Look, I found Bannon's interviews really interesting. I think he hit on a lot of good points that I didn't fully understand until after the election and when he was out of Trump's team. The problem with Bannon is the last 2 years he's gone down a real deep, deep rabbit hole, you could say.
Oh, yeah.
He's hanging out with that guy who, the former billionaire, Chinese billionaire, just doing weird shit. Like, he got done for fraud or something recently.
Doesn't surprise me.
So, yeah, but to me it was a bit of a surprise because he just didn't seem like the guy that would do that thing. But
Steve Bannon has one very, very particular skill. He knows how to make people angry. That is his one very particular skill. And he knows how to make people angry en masse about issues. And, of course, anger is one of the best political motivators there is. And that is his one particular skill, is how to make people very, very angry. And that, obviously, people in 2016 were very, very angry. They were very, very fired up about these issues and where the country was going and, you know, who Hillary Clinton was and what her vision was. And this, you know, Washington swamp and their country had been taken away from them. People were angry. And that motivated them en masse to vote for people. I mean, a lot of them didn't like everything about Donald Trump, but they were so angry and motivated that he was much better than their alternatives.
Yeah.
And I think many of those voters, had they not have been so riled up by Bannon, would have been voters that would have stayed home in most elections.
Yeah.
But they were incentivized in this extreme way, which was extremely impressive. And Steve Bannon certainly has that skill. But as a person, I don't think he's terribly powerful.
Well, it sort of sounds like at least when it comes to that strategy, you probably see it as something that doesn't go the long game.
No, it doesn't.
Like, I think it definitely works. It's just a matter of, like,
I think,
it doesn't work over a 10, 20 year
I think
period.
We've just proven that it doesn't.
Yeah.
Haven't we?
Yeah.
It worked in 2016. It didn't follow through to 2020.
Yeah. But that could also be because he had different people advising him on campaign strategy.
I think it was a mixture of things. It was a mixture of things. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the policy got lost behind President Trump's personality.
Yeah, but also he's. I think what really killed Trump was his response to COVID. If you look at the people that voted for him in 2016 versus the people that didn't vote for him and voted for, like, actively voted for Joe Biden this time around, they were the people who mainly swung. And if you look at a lot of cases, it's generally the answer is his response to COVID.
And the thing is, I mean, the fact is Joe Biden's not offering any different response and hasn't offered anything different. The Democrats aren't offering anything different, but their messaging has been very strong on it, as their messaging is on a lot of things. And I think perhaps if the Republican Party had pushed harder on the fact that Fauci said several times everything he presented to Donald Trump did. And Fauci presents himself as this, you know, godly bipartisan character, then surely his words should mean a lot to people, to the swing voters. And I think pushing harder on the fact that the Democrats were offering nothing different is very important. But had it obviously have not been for COVID, I think it would have been a landslide for President Trump.
Yeah, I think the whole COVID thing, I mean, it changed the whole world. Like, it just changed everything.
And it's unbelievable that he lost in a way, because still 54% of Americans said they were better off than they were 4 years ago, which is usually a winning formula.
Yeah, but as we know, when it comes to politics, you know, polls like that, et cetera, aren't what gets you the win. It's the Electoral College, it's the
first
seats.
The first debate didn't help either.
Yeah.
If President Trump had behaved in the first debate like Vice President Pence did in his debate, I think he would have scored a lot more points.
You. Yes, you. Are you intrigued by this episode? If so, go to our footer on the website, neuralle.com. We're going to give you an insight each week. It's going to be on business, marketing, or a topic that we covered in the episode at all. We'd love your support, and it would help us in developing the intellect around this series. But without going on too much longer, let's get back into this episode. I think the whole COVID thing was ultimately his undoing again, because things got washed behind his personality. So it's going to be interesting 4 years, I reckon. I don't know if the election over there has actually been finally called decided, but it's
not
sort
until,
of quite obvious that Biden's going to win.
Not until the electors sit and declare who they're voting for. I think it's December the electors sit, and then in January, there's obviously the inauguration.
But it's pretty obvious that, like, I don't even watch or listen to many of Trump's tweets anymore, because I think it's quite obvious.
I think it's quite clear that Joe Biden is the president-elect of the United States.
So what did you learn from that election period about messaging and strategy, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I think what you can learn from that is that even with good policy, the wrong face can be a real issue. I mean, Donald Trump had impeccable policy really up until COVID, which was something that the Democrats would have made the same mistakes with. You know, remember, Donald Trump was the racist xenophobe for closing the borders to China so early, according to Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden and others. So they weren't offering anything different. In fact, perhaps even less. But I think that Donald Trump's personality certainly is a very authoritative figure. You know, people look to Donald Trump and they think, oh, that's a strong president. Unfortunately, the vision of a strong leader is great when you have good policy and good outcomes. But when something is out of your control, like COVID, which has been out of the control of most leaders around the world, and would have been out of control of Joe Biden, people look to you and still think, you're a strong leader. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you fix it? Why didn't you take control? Because we've been relying on you and you've been taking control of all of these other things. Why couldn't you take control of this? And I think that imaging of a strong leader not having control of something is much worse than, say, if Joe Biden was there and people think, oh, Joe's not really up to it, you know, we can't blame him because, look, you know, he was never going to do it. That's much better position to be in than, oh, my God, you're such a strong, authoritative leader. Now look what's happened. You know, it just was a bad image.
I'd love to see Tom Ballard in this interview with you. Like, he'd have so many disagreements. But I understand what you're saying is the messaging was very wrong. I'm intrigued to hear your thoughts on, because I think COVID, let's talk about COVID in general, because that to me has been the ultimate trend of the year. It's quite obvious. It's accelerated things that were already happening.
Yeah.
Maybe brought them forward 5 years closer.
Absolutely.
There we can talk about locally some big trends. Like I've just anecdotally noticed in my generation, people moving more away from the cities.
Yep, because of remote work. We'll see a lot more of that.
More remote work. So regional Victoria being more and more important. Which is
excellent. Regional Victoria is a fantastic place.
Great. But also interesting that some areas like Mornington Peninsula still is covered in Metro Melbourne, which is bizarre. Which is so obvious that, you know, they just didn't want people going down to
their holiday homes, basically.
Their holiday homes, exactly. Probably because of those two dickheads who came back from some alpine retreat in Canada
infected
20 or so people.
Everyone in Portsea, and then they were getting sued by all the people they went to dinner with.
So that's
quite funny.
I think that's probably the reason.
It wasn't funny that they got infected, but it was funny that the immediate reaction of all the people they infected was, I'm going to sue you.
It was pretty funny.
Very,
very funny.
Typical of that sort of.
So that's happened. Remote work has probably been the big underlying component of that. People reevaluating what they're doing. I know I have personally. The other big thing I think will start to come out in the next couple of years is more this idea of localization as opposed to globalization. Mm-hmm. It was already happening in some ways. But I think with COVID and the impact on supply chains, you know, the big word in our supply chain clientele at the moment when they do their marketing is resilience, which is really just moving away from China more locally.
Very much so.
I think geopolitically, I was saying to you as we're coming up in the lift, Japan has just signed up to the Five Eyes program. China has been like a little upset child through this whole period. And people's views, at least locally, people who I would never have suspected are very much off China. How do you see the policy impacts of the US in our region? Because I look at this whole thing as like Australia has changed in a way that we've realized we're not as, we shouldn't be as reliant on the US as maybe we have in the past.
My biggest concern with the Biden administration is that he will be less, he will stand up less to China, basically, is the essence of that. I think that Joe Biden won't be strong against the Chinese government. And I've been quoted in American newspapers saying the only way to deal with China is to stand up to them. Mm. You have to be absolutely immovable in your position. Otherwise, they'll walk all over you. That's what they're used to doing, is in some cases, literally running people over and walking all over them.
Yeah, well, the slice, the salami strategy is literally their strategy. You read some of their geopolitical war books and it's literally.
And that's my biggest concern, is that I don't think that the Biden administration will be as equipped to deal with China in that really strong confrontational way, which is what you need.
Because
China doesn't want a war.
No, they can't afford it.
They can't afford a war.
Well, the China, really, the CCP cannot afford a war.
No.
They will lose ultimately control.
Mm.
The population won't deal with it. I'm reading a really interesting book at the moment called, I think it's called The State by Richard McGregor.
Mm.
The Party. And it's about the CCP. It's so fascinating.
I think the scary thing for the CCP is that they want expansionism, right?
They need it.
But they also realise that they are struggling to cope with rebellious aspects of their population currently.
Yes.
And the more they expand, and the wider they lay their net and the thinner the net gets,
The more
chance there is for them to lose control in their central areas.
Yeah.
And that's terrifying for the Chinese.
Yeah.
Because control is everything. That's the only reason they're still there. So what people have
Which
to
is
realize,
pretty remarkable, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. And they don't want a war. Because if they send their military abroad to fight a war against, you know, the West, effectively, then suddenly at home it's not so great.
Yeah.
And they don't want that. But what you need to be very clear with China is, don't do that, because one, it's not going to work for you. But also, we're not movable in our position. This is the position.
Mm.
We're not movable. You deal with it or you don't deal with it.
Yeah. And that is probably the most interesting component of this development of this idea of the Indo-Pacific.
Mm.
You know, you've got the Quad, like I said, Five Eyes plus Japan. Yes. I feel like we're coming to a point where, look, I don't know, no one can predict the future, but I totally understand what you're saying. I read this article recently that you can actively measure the disdain for the CCP by GDP percentage points. So if their GDP ever goes below 6%, if unemployment goes to a certain level, they're in very, very big trouble locally.
The fact that people still believe that they're growing at 7.1% every year on year. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, even after inflation, it's probably near flat.
Mm.
Yeah, there's so many things. The CCP is really fascinating because everything is about the party. So internal security, the army, and propaganda. That's the three main areas they have to control. This book is just, I really recommend that people use it if they're interested in China. Like, you learn about little things like it's called the Red Machine. There's one thing called the Red Machine.
Mm.
Top 50 executives, all the vice premiers for their departments, they all have this red phone in their office. Mm. And it's the only encrypted phone between the party leadership, which is not the Politburo, which is the larger governing body, but you're talking about the nine people that are in charge, plus you know, all these top executives, and it's both a, what are they called? It's both a blessing and a curse having that phone in your office, because you can get a party leader call you up and say, "Hey, can you give my kid a job?" And if you don't do it, then
exactly. And I mean, China is a very, very scary place for the people in there, and people think, "Oh, we're totally relying on China," and we are.
Well, I had this conversation on Sunday at a dinner, so you give me your thoughts on it first. Why do you think we're not totally reliant on China?
It's not that I don't think we're not totally reliant on China. I think we are heavily reliant on China at the moment. What I take issue with is that they're not reliant on us.
Yeah.
That's what people always seem to have this thing, we're totally reliant on China, but they could walk away from us at any stage. They can't.
Yeah.
You know, they're not a resource wealthy nation.
Yeah.
And if they don't continue to grow, then it's very, the only reason the CCP have remained where they are is because of this constant economic promise they're giving people.
Yeah.
You know, look, we've got jobs, there are factories, this and this and this. This growing middle class in China is what is keeping the CCP there, because they can say, look, we're creating wealth.
Mm.
If suddenly they don't have access to the minerals and resources we're offering them, there is no economic growth in China.
Yeah. Well, that was very interesting in that book, what they covered during the GFC. They had, you know, bargain basement prices when they had the money. They bought, or a lot of their state-owned properties bought assets in Australia and Brazil. And so that's probably the greatest issue we have now is that we're used to our system where you can't just take those assets. Mm. So how do you make them more reliable?
Mm.
Like, let's say they've put in all these tariffs on Australian products, wine, lobster, et cetera. If you're in charge of policy when it comes to China, let's say the Prime Minister has a think tank group that he's trying to put together, what do you do?
Well, I'm not a terribly big fan of tariffs generally, because I'm a free market person. But in some cases, you do need punitive measures. The first step I would like to think would be to incentivize Australian conglomerates to buy back those assets at above market price. You would think that would be the first step.
Buy back as in, and when you say conglomerates, they could be any company.
Well, it might be Jen Reinhardt's company, it might be Twiggy Forrest's company, it might be a Melbourne-based real estate firm. It could be anyone that has the capital they're willing to put up. And I think offering to subsidise their investment by covering the part of the investment that goes above market price, or maybe even a bit more than that, so that they actually end up buying those assets below market price and returning them to Australian ownership. And you may have caveats on that about they can't sell it to someone that's not Australian, they have to keep it for X amount of years, they can't split it up, whatever it might be, I think would be the first way to go. Because I initially like to think the best way to go is by growing Australian companies rather than punishing foreign companies.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's the most positive way to look at it. If that failed, you know, if it did, and then you could start looking at punitive measures for Chinese companies. So you could look at any Chinese company that is part-owned by the Chinese government or has a significant connection to the Chinese government.
Which is pretty much all of them.
All of them, exactly. Yeah. You might say, well, they have a 70% tax rate if they own a major Australian asset.
Mm.
You know, and that is immediately going to force them to sell the asset. Because, you know, people say, oh, but that's, you know, that's not very free market of you, because that's going to push those companies out. But in this scenario, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is push the companies away. Yeah.
Do you see any potential reactions to Australia? Like, that's the one thing I think about, is Australian companies in China and the potential impacts on those companies. Like, there's obviously going to be collateral damage. I just don't know to what extent we have or Australian private companies have assets in China.
I think the bigger question, the more pertinent question, is to what extent do we have a choice?
Right.
At this point in global geopolitics, I don't think there is much choice between stand up to China or let them do whatever they want.
Yeah.
You know, there is only one option, which is to stand up to the Chinese government.
Yeah.
If the Chinese Communist Party say, we're going to tariff all Australian goods, right, that's all good and well.
Mm.
And we sitting here, we think, oh my God, that's going to destroy our businesses. And that's a real concern. More so is raising consumer prices in China.
Yeah.
And the Chinese middle class is growing, and they're becoming more and more financially aware of their consumer prices, their consumer costs, and their cost of living in China. The Chinese government has retained a huge amount of their middle class population because the cost to live in China remained relatively low compared to other countries, because they can buy in massive volumes, costs are lower, they then pass it on to the consumer. The more consumer costs start to rise in China, the less livable it becomes.
Mm.
The more people start to seek to move abroad, the less of a taxable middle-class population they have, the less of those businesses are growing, and it becomes very, very precarious for the Chinese government.
Yeah.
You know, if we were here suddenly, imagine you're sitting here and we're all in Melbourne, everything that's great, and you go to buy some lamb, because it's just recently, today I think they announced that they're going to start going after the Australian lamb industry.
Really?
Yeah, the $780 million lamb industry.
Wow.
Let's say you went to buy a lamb chop tomorrow, and that one lamb chop was $25.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't be buying that lamb chop. And then imagine you go to get a bottle of wine, and that one bottle of wine is $450.
Yeah.
And it's just a normal bottle of wine. Then you can't buy that wine. You're suddenly not consuming what you would usually be consuming. So the Chinese government and all of the companies in China that import these things, suddenly no one's consuming them. And suddenly there's no product coming in to be consumed. They can't import, they can't export.
Mm.
Who's going to buy? It suddenly becomes a massive economic problem within China.
Yeah.
And if you suddenly woke up tomorrow and everything was 400 times more expensive, you'd start thinking, oh, where else can I move? Where can I go? How can I do this? Because this isn't feasible.
The only problem with that is that requires a long-term position by Australia, which we saw. My frustration here locally was, great example, Kerry Stokes comes out and says, like, why are we doing this? We should be, you know, getting along with the party, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And my concern is it's people like that that have an obvious bias, monetary bias, who push or pressure the government to not be able to make long-term hard decisions.
No, that is an absolute issue, is the government not making long-term hard decisions. And as I've said and been quoted before saying, you must stand up to China and that must be consistent. As I was saying before, you can't waver on your point. You have to say, this is our position, it doesn't change. This is Australia's position. I think it's fantastic to have China as a trading partner. That's not an issue.
Yeah.
But it's about free trade and fair trade. We need to get what we get and they get what they get, and has to come to some kind of balance.
Yeah.
And unless you say to the Chinese government, the Chinese government have never heard no before, ever.
Yes.
We want this, okay, we want this, okay, we want this, okay, we want this, okay, fine. But you need to start saying, we want this, no, we'll give you this.
Yeah.
You need to start, instead of saying to China, you can take this, you say, we will give you this for X. We're not having that. I mean, my issue with the Chinese government as well in their relationship with Australia is about infrastructure. I think a lot of people are concerned. John Holland, which has a beautiful building over there in Melbourne, they've done a great job doing that building up, owned by the Chinese government. Well, even more specifically, really, the Chinese Communist Party, majority stake. So when we're putting them in charge of building our infrastructure, what message is that sending to China? The message that's sending is, we're going to do this for you. Here, take this. Take our infrastructure. Do this to our infrastructure. We're prioritising you. You know, it sends a message to China that they are our priority in trading.
Yeah.
What we need to show China is, much like them, our priority is our own nation. You know, there is one thing that the Chinese are, and that's intensely nationalistic. Right? So it's very hard for them to argue with nationalism from other countries. And we need to say to them, listen, China, your priority is China. That's great. You're the Chinese government. That should be your priority. You shouldn't give a shit about Australia. You're the Chinese government. What's the point? But we're the Australian government, so we don't give a shit about you.
Yeah. I can't see. Well, look, the tide is turning in terms of, like, mentally where people are at with that. At some point, people will get to that.
You need the right leader.
Yeah.
And that's what people liked in Donald Trump, is they felt like Donald Trump was the kind of leader that could sit down with someone and say, listen, this is about America. It's not about China. I don't care about China. I care about America. It's my country. And I'm not sure if there is that person in Australia that people could imagine that happening in them saying that. Because Scott Morrison is a very, very diplomatic person.
Yeah, he's not going to be the one to...
As is Anthony Albanese, is even less confrontational.
Yeah.
Now, I think Anthony Albanese would cry if an ice cream van chased him.
Come on.
So I don't...
You know, everyone who's on the left is just going to, you know, they're going to have a field day with that.
I think a lot of them are going to love it because he's not very much liked on the left.
Really?
No.
I don't mind him.
I think he's an extremely reasonable person.
Yeah.
As far as how he's dealt with COVID.
Yeah.
I think his cooperation with the federal government has been excellent.
Yeah.
And that's what the Labor Party don't like.
So who is the person foreign policy-wise that would be the best for this?
It would be the best for it?
Yeah.
It's a good question.
Because we've got, who's the foreign minister at the moment? Melissa Payne?
Mm.
Yeah. She was the defence minister until recently. I can't think of a person in the government.
I don't think it's one person that would have to do it. I think you would have to elect a government on that platform. On that platform where they had committed to this strategy. And I think it would be worth discussing it with the opposition to create a bipartisan strategy for the next 10 years.
Hmm.
I think it would be worth having a 10-year plan, 5-to-10-year plan, bipartisan, on how we're going to deal with the China issue.
Do you see, I don't know if there is a committee for it at the moment, but there is a committee in the US for China. So in the US, they have a Senate committee, I believe. Maybe it is a House of Reps committee, I can't remember. But Marco Rubio seems to be the leader of that committee.
Mm-hmm.
And they focus, it's like a China watch, essentially, keeping the US competitive against China. And he's probably been the best to talk about IP theft in the last 4 years. Is that the way to start it?
I think you have the issue in Australia that committees end up being extremely politicised.
Mm.
And I don't think that dealing with China should be a political issue, really.
Mm.
I think it should be a bipartisan issue.
Yeah.
Because it's about Australia's future and Australia's sovereignty and Australia's security. For a long time, military issues and intelligence issues have been a bipartisan issue.
Mm.
And I think as much as I might joke about Anthony Albanese, and it's just, I do joke about him, but he does seem like someone that you could come to that arrangement with.
Yeah. Well, to be honest with you, I listened to Penny Wong's statement in the Senate after that image came out. I actually really like the way that she's so stern when it comes to some foreign policy issues.
There are some issues that just should be bipartisan.
Yeah.
They just should be.
Yeah.
And one of them should be that we protect Australia's sovereignty and security at all costs against the Chinese Communist Party.
Mm.
That should be number one, two, and three. And, as I think Anthony Albanese has come out previously and hasn't been too positive about the BRI deal in Victoria, as has the Prime Minister.
Well, that's have a lot of people. It's sort of a fait accompli that's going to be thrown up.
Absolutely, and it should be.
Yeah.
And there are some issues that should be. Bill Shorten would have been someone you could never, ever make a bipartisan arrangement with. I don't think he would have had it.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. I don't think so. He was a political animal in a way that Anthony Albanese isn't. You know, Bill Shorten wanted to win at all costs, and I don't think he would have sat down and said, oh, let's come to a happy agreement with the Morrison government to make them look good.
Mm.
I don't think he would have. Whereas I think Anthony Albanese, as much as he may not be a confrontational man, is probably someone that you could have that discussion with. I can't think of many examples where he's been particularly aggressively against any policies the government's put up to do with COVID.
No.
And make no mistake, this is a crisis of COVID magnitude. The crisis of the Chinese Communist Party's influence.
Yes, it is the CCP virus, in essence, that escapes China because they were incompetent at managing it, essentially, just like with SARS. It's funny, again, that book mentions SARS and how that was an existential moment for the CCP in China because that really kicked up a fuss amongst the population. We could probably talk about this for hours, but I want to get into something before we finish with rapid fire questions for you.
Yeah.
And that question was around, you know, what you mentioned before, getting along, bipartisan policy, et cetera. When you look at like the current state of politics and the strategy, you know, you spoke before about groups like GetUp.
Mm-hmm.
groups like yours, they're obviously diametrically opposed to one another when it comes to campaigning. But do you ever find, are there ever moments where you find that you can, the two of your two groups or others, get along?
I can't say I have encountered those moments, but I also can't say that there would never be those moments.
Yeah.
Again, there are some issues, as I've said, that should be bipartisan. If the head of GetUp called me tomorrow and said, we're doing an anti-BRI campaign because we think the Chinese government has persecuted minorities, which they have, allegedly, but they have, you know, the Uyghur people, the Muslim minority
have.
And other minorities, and we want to do a campaign against Chinese human rights violations and how they impact Australian policy. I'll say, well, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I'll come on there and I'll talk about human rights violations in the Chinese Communist. But there are some issues that should be bipartisan and are bipartisan in many ways. I can't say that I'll ever get that phone call because I don't think I will.
Are there many other topics that you think are bipartisan?
I'm sure there are, but I can't think of any. Are there any that you think should be bipartisan?
If I look at the policy areas that were stated on the Victoria Forward area, I think people are pretty universally bipartisan on Country Victoria.
I was just about to say that.
I think the one thing that you mentioned is, like, regional transport is a real issue.
Yeah.
It had been mentioned, like, there are VCs here in Australia who say they would happily fund, because it's a fucking great investment, fast train networks between the major regional towns. And Melbourne, like the obvious being Ballarat, Bendigo, Albury, Wodonga. What is there in Gippsland? Probably look at like Sale.
Yeah.
And in the west, where would you look there? Who knows? The point is that you need, we need, it would be amazing if you can live in Ballarat or Bendigo, where there are big companies there. We have friends who went and worked for Mars in Ballarat. And you can get a fast train into the city and be in there 45, 60 minutes. It should be that, like that, you know, will be the thing, I believe, that will push Victoria past Sydney quicker than the 2025 current forecast.
Totally.
More so than anything, because if you look at our geography, it is so flat in Victoria in the main areas of growth in comparison to Sydney, which is completely surrounded by a harbour and blue mountains. You could just keep going and going and going around the national parks and keep expanding little, you know, isolated areas like Ballarat, Bendigo, et cetera.
I agree. I think that's an issue that should be, but unfortunately, the current government is fairly, has previously, and I don't see any massive change other than for political gain.
The problem is it is all politics.
But yeah, they've been very city-centric.
Yes. Doesn't win votes.
No. But I do think that it's something that should be done, and there's absolutely no excuse for it not being done.
Yeah.
And even if it doesn't, not every policy position you take has to win you votes. Not every single one. You need some key policy positions that win you votes, but at the end of the day, you should have gone into government to govern and govern well.
Yeah.
And produce good outcomes for the state.
Yeah.
And at the moment, Country Victoria has been disgracefully ignored.
Yes.
And I don't think there's ever too much investment in Country Victoria.
Yeah, well, again, it just comes back to votes, I think, unfortunately. Mm. They, whether it's been Liberal or Labor, they have not viewed Country or regional Victoria as an area to focus on because of votes.
And the problem is, even if it was a bipartisan issue, and even the China issue, if it was a bipartisan issue, inevitably you're going to have both parties having a different way they think of dealing with
it. Yeah, of course.
Even if you both agree on the issue,
yeah,
how do you deal with that issue?
The other one I was going to mention was infrastructure.
Mm.
But again, we'll come back to the point that you made, is how you do that is completely different. Like, a rail link is probably what the more rail is probably what the left wants. More road is probably what the right wants.
I think you should have both. More of both. More. I think we should build Metro too.
I think we should just do it all.
Yeah, and build the roads.
Like, but that is one thing that the CCP has done well, is infrastructure spending during all this creates jobs and it compounds in value in years to come. Whereas fiscal spending, just giving people money, has a great short-term effect, but not a long-term effect.
Well, certainly. I can't say that I'm not concerned about the massive amounts of debt we've taken on paying JobKeeper. Yeah. But I think that when you balance infrastructure spending with how much debt you have to take, and you make responsible private-public joint ventures an option, and purely private ventures an option, I think everyone agrees that infrastructure is great.
Yeah.
But not everyone. I mean, I personally believe that the city of Melbourne and regional, we've already spoken about regional Victoria, but to talk about the city for a second, could rival Singapore in its oasis if the right infrastructure was made and our gardens were expanded and certain major attractions were put in and, you know, some beautiful pieces of architecture and infrastructure. It could be an amazing city. Mm. But we need to make those long-term plans and make those long-term investments.
Mm.
And unfortunately, that requires an awful lot of vision. And I don't think that Daniel Andrews has much vision past the year 2022.
I guess we'll see when it comes up to the, to the election. By the way, when does the election cycle technically start? Is it 6 months prior to the election here in Victoria, or is it three?
Well, legally, for fundraising purposes, it begins as soon as the last election ends.
Yeah, of course.
So the cycle is whenever you want it to be, really.
But when we talk about running and the media,
I would say a year. I would say you want that. The year of 2022 will be, for, especially for this election, is when it should really, really ramp up.
Well, you've got 2 years. 2 years to work out your strategy, I guess.
Well, really 1 year.
Well, yeah, 1 year. All right, let's jump into some rapid fire
questions. Yeah, go ahead.
What's your morning and evening routine looking like at the moment?
I get up and I work.
Yeah.
And I work. And I have lunch. And I work. And I work. I work. And then I go to bed and I do the same thing. I have dinner, obviously, somewhere in there. But yeah. I like to dine out because it makes me stop working.
Yeah.
If I'm working at home, if I'm eating at home, rather, for dinner or even for lunch, I'm still working. Whereas I find if I go out to a restaurant to eat, it forces me to put everything away and stop.
And stop eating. Completely, yeah. Yeah, we have this every Wednesday. We make sure we go, like, see a movie or go out for dinner or something like that. It sort of stops me from even just being on my phone. What's been your go-to item in the fridge during the lockdown period?
That is an excellent question. Go-to item in the fridge. I like goat's cheese, Meredith goat's cheese.
Meredith? Nice. You know the jar.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's so Moorish. You can finish a jar and not even know.
Yeah. I have a mild. If I have too much lactose, I'll be feeling it.
Yeah.
But it's so good. If you do that, like that goat's cheese on some like toasted bread.
Yeah.
Is fucking amazing. Absolutely amazing.
So yeah, that would definitely be it.
If you were to consider a podcast, a doco, a movie, a TV show during this whole lockdown period, what has been your go-to or what has surprised you the most at all?
That's interesting. Well, there are some political ones. I always listen to the Ben Shapiro show every day. I never miss the Ben Shapiro show because I like his common sense conservatism that is not really extreme in any way. It's just very, very logical considered and rational and conservative. I think that's very, very good. But people were probably surprised that often when I watch television, as much as I keep up with the news and watch Peter Cradle and FedEx, people like that, I try and watch things that take my mind off politics when I'm able to watch television. So I love watching the show, even reruns of Fake or Fortune. I don't know if you've seen that show, BBC show, where someone comes forward with their painting and they work out whether it's a genuine work by said artist or a fake.
Okay.
Podcasts. I like creepy podcasts like Let's Not Meet and Creepy Caffeine and things like that. I like those sort of podcasts. Just something that takes my mind completely away from politics in a completely different direction, because sometimes you do have to give your brain a bit of a break.
Yeah, you've got to give your brain a break. I agree with that. I think the big thing I've taken on this year, you probably saw when we were out on the balcony earlier, was the bonsai stuff. I went deep from probably December of last year. I've been saying for years that I wanted one.
I've been saying that for a long time.
Yeah, and you just make excuses. Yeah. And then my mother bought me one for Christmas and I was like, wow, now I have to get serious about this because I cannot let this thing die.
Yeah.
And then it went from one tree to I think I'm at about eight or so now.
Wow.
And it's great because it just, like you said, it takes your mind off. I can't use my phone. I can't be too focused on screens. Mm. You just, you know, you let all the shit come out of your head basically. And I don't know, it's just it's a nice thing.
Absolutely.
I think. Ed, it's good to see you, mate.
Oh, it's good to see you too. Thank you for having me on.
I think that's a nice hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah, fantastic.
I feel like we could talk about a lot of things.
I don't think I was too controversial.
No, definitely not.
I think people would be surprised how non-controversial a person I actually am.
Yes.
I think people imagine me to be this absolute conservative zealot that has all of these extreme opinions. My opinions aren't really that terribly extreme.
This is what you said in your prior interview, and also With Tom Ballard, he said the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he... I can't actually remember if he's still doing that podcast, but yes, I would agree. I think if I'm going to have any political consultant, because we're moving more and more away from political stuff, I think someone who's more on the marketing side makes sense. Does, yeah. So,
and Tom's a very nice guy.
He's a great guy. Where can people find what you're doing, where you are on the interwebs, yeah, where are the best places?
Check out Victoria Forward on Facebook particularly. At our website, of course, and sign up for our newsletter if you want, or if you want to keep up to date. I don't post much on social media myself, and I don't like Twitter because I think Twitter is a terrible place.
Yeah, I've well and truly checked out Twitter.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have more and more. But yeah, have a look at Victoria Forward on Facebook and just
Facebook.
Even if you don't agree with us,
yeah,
it's always good to know what the other side's thinking.
Yeah, I'd say that. And then conversely, if you're more on your side of politics, go check out the Get Ups of the World. It's always interesting.
Do the Ups. It's great to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Ed, thanks for coming in, mate.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you do like it, please subscribe. And of course, like if you're watching the YouTube video as well. We'd really appreciate that. You can also find our Clips channel in the description. For audio, if you're not already listening, you can search Uncommon on Pocket Cast, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts quite easily. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon on YouTube. And for behind the scenes takes and clips on social media, then definitely check out at @uncommon_show on Instagram. But otherwise, look, thanks so much for tuning in. And until next time, thanks for listening.